Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Big Footy Women's Podcast, possibly the only women's podcast anywhere without any women on it, but we're working on that, aren't we, Peter?
Indeed we are. Great to be here. And where can they find you on Big Footy, just in case there's a female out there that's interested in football or currently plays football that wants to come on, who knows a bit about the women's footy scene in particular? How can they contact you?
Well, I'm, of course, the Wookie on Big Footy, the _ Wookie. You can reach me by personal messaging me or contacting me via the Women's Footy Forum, of which I'm the moderator, on Big Footy. And we'll take it from there. Of course, myself being the Wookie, with me tonight, as always, when we talk women's footy, is Peter Holden, or Crowded House, as he's known on Big Footy. But he also does some work for Girls Play Footy, where he commentates on women's football things there, hence his role here. Good evening, Pete.
Hey, great to be back here, and for those who didn't hear the main podcast, great to be back from the United States as well, and from their Nationals back in October.
Big thing, the Nationals. People that don't really pay attention to women's footy don't really appreciate the size of the event that they try to put on there.
It is huge over there in the US. I mean, we're talking about they've got at least five fields going at once. They have to try and find this venue. In this case, it was Lakewood Ranch, Florida, where they found five football fields. This is obviously the women's and the men. The men take over four football fields. The women have their own field. And this year, when they had the Nationals, there was a five-team Division One and a three-team Division Two. And that three-team Division Two is essentially made up of combined sides. So for, let's say, men's clubs that have a few women that train with them, like two or three women, they managed to pull together a side. For example, one team was Portland, Seattle, Arizona, and also Tampa Bay. They managed to join together to form a side of the Portland banner. Montreal, Boston teamed up with Philadelphia, Des Moines, Chicago. They made another side. So that's what happens in their lower division. The great thing is their Division One, their five-team division, is all clubs that have actually got 18 or more players.
So it's a big event. I take it you had a good time.
Oh, absolutely fantastic! Stinking hot there, you know, in the low 30s out there in Florida. Great ground. In fact, Lakewood Ranch, the grounds there, which are normally used as soccer fields, but it's like open plains, was so good. There's some blokes there going, the surface was better than some, and they used to play VFL football. They said it's better than that surface. The quality of the surface was magnificent. It allowed great football, and in fact, out of that, just into this week, the USAFL released their top 10 games that were filmed for 2016. They did like Central Tournament, Western Regional, and a few other tournaments, men's and women. Three women's matches made that top 10, including the San Francisco versus Denver women's match. It's the Iron Maidens versus the Lady Bulldogs, was rated as the number one game in the United States this year.
Excellent. Top stuff. Well, let's move on to stuff of a more local flavour, Pete. And the fixtures come out for the AFL Women's competition starting in February next year. And also,
and boy, oh boy, are the interstaters spewing already.
Well, it does seem, I mean, because we've got an odd number of games, there's only seven rounds before we get to the final. So some teams have only got three home games, some teams have got four. GWS and Brisbane only have three. Adelaide have three in Adelaide and one in the Northern Territory. But there does seem to be a bit of an issue over why couldn't the Melbourne clubs, who were playing each other a few times, not have given up those home games to go to and allow GWS and Brisbane to get their full fill in terms of that. That does seem to be a bit odd.
How it works out is that every Melbourne-based team travels twice, where all the interstaters are travelling three or four times. So this is the big thing that they're spewing about, saying, well, clearly, you know, some of the, you know, we'd say, for example, GWS or Brisbane, as you say, travel down to Melbourne, why can't they flip the fixture on that? I think part of it comes down to broadcast and obviously the availability of broadcast trucks and equipment, etc., in the other states and at other times, and getting commentary teams around everywhere. So I think that might have played into it a little bit. But yeah, it certainly does lean it to the Melbourne sides, the fixture. And even without going through the list, which we will soon, I think if the betting agencies have still got Fremantle up there as favourite or joint favourite, they're smoking something illegal, because now the draw has gone against Fremantle. You can just whack them down the ladder. They are not making the top two to play off in the final.
Fremantle's draw is actually not too bad. Two games at Fremantle Oval, a game at Domain Stadium, which is a double header, and a game at Rushton Park, which they are familiar with Fremantle. They do play there in the pre-season a fair bit. That's not a bad effort.
You actually have to look closely at it. What Fremantle would have wanted out of their four home games is they would have wanted as many difficult sides as possible, ideally all four Melbourne sides, to travel to Fremantle because they need every advantage they can get. If they can beat the harder teams at home, that helps them out in their efforts to try and get to the top of the draw. Now, they would have preferred, according to this list, I have got them playing Brisbane at home at Fremantle Oval and Adelaide. They're two teams they really should knock off. They would have preferred actually to play them away. They could have counted them as away wins, which is, you know, a bit like the old soccer philosophy where, you know, you bank on your home wins, and if you pinch your one or two away wins, that puts you in good stead to climb up the ladder. They would have preferred the easier games away. Same with Carlton. They've got Carlton, which I rate them as the weaker out of the four Melbourne teams. They probably would have preferred a Bulldogs or Melbourne to be played, so if they could have pinched a win against them, that hurts their position on the ladder and can help Fremantle climb.
Speaking of Carlton, three games at Princes Park. It's not a bad result.
Yeah, at Icon Park, just going through their fixture, their first one, of course, on February 11 against GWS, put that one in the bank. That is a Carlton win. The other games they've got are the Western Bulldogs. You've got to favour the Bulldogs in that draw. And then they've got Brisbane at Icon Park, and you'd have to say, put that one in the bank. So I'd say they get two out of three on that.
They do, of course, start the season against Collingwood at Olympic Park, notably being called Olympic Park by the AFL and not the Holden Centre. So that's a fun little quirk.
Very interesting. Maybe because of the Toyota deal, who knows?
Actually, that's a good point.
That could be the reason why it's being called Olympic Park Oval. And I should point out, for that ground, which doesn't have a fence, and a few other grounds, whenever there is a game, a women's match, where it's not a double header, so that means they're not playing before or after the men's JLT Community Series game, when it's a standalone fixture, it is free entry to those games.
They're not going to have a lot of...
Collingwood-Carlton thing, you can go along, Wookie. It will cost you nothing to go Friday, 3rd of February.
Well, it'll cost me flights over to Melbourne. flights, accommodation. It's a night game, you know.
But you get in for nothing.
it's interesting because I think Carlton aren't actually allowed to have lights in Princess Park, which precludes them from playing those games there. So all their games at Princess Park are like at 11:30 in the morning.
Or a twilight fixture at 5:05 on a Saturday.
So there's some fun stuff there. One of Carlton's games is, of course, the curtain raiser to the Carlton St Kilda game being played there during the NAB Cup. There are a few double headers in the draw.
One thing I do like about the draw is bringing back some of what I call the State League stage. You mentioned Fremantle Oval with the Waffle. You're bringing back the likes of Theberton Oval for Adelaide.
Hasn't even seen a state game in about 20 years.
Was it Woodville or West Torrens? One of the two that played out of there before the merger.
West Torrens played out of there.
Yeah, so they're bringing back that ground, which is fantastic. See, obviously, Witten Oval, which looked great on TV. Norwood Oval has also been brought back as well. I guess the only sour point is Casey Fields. No one likes going out to Casey Fields, and Melbourne have got two games out there.
Yeah, Carlton was one of them. And actually, there's a curtain raiser for that too. It's a curtain raiser to the Carlton-Melbourne JLT series game now. GWS playing a game at Manuka, two games at Blacktown, so they're on fairly decent facilities. The question mark for me is South Pine, the Brisbane game. All three of them are at South Pine. I have no idea what the conditions are like.
A brand new facility being built out in North Brisbane. So apparently the surface will be top notch because it'll be brand new. But you could almost call it like a Yoronga type stadium out there. So it'll be very much a community type footy ground.
Now, just on that, I think there's a little bit of angst because they actually thought they were going to be playing at Yoronga.
Yeah, I guess maybe the AFL Queensland trying to get bang for their buck. New stadium and they want to try it out. Because I reckon Yoronga would have been a nice ground. The question is, I mean, I think that it's full-time football. I don't believe there's any cricket or anything on Yoronga. Yeah, I thought Yeronga would have been, because they play the QWAFL Grand Final there and the QAFL Grand Final. It's a great little atmosphere, and if you've got 5,000 people there, that'll be a perfect little ground. And it's got lights, so you can play night football there. The only thing is there's no, you've got to put scaffolding in, etc., for broadcast facilities. But, yeah, I find it perplexing why it's not at Yeronga. But, again, it may be just because South Pine's brand new, they want to break it in and show it off, in other words. Mm.
Adelaide, of course, as you mentioned, playing at Theberton. They've also got a night game at Nord, which is being televised.
And that's good. I mean, hopefully that will bring some of the supporters in. And out of Adelaide's games, the draw has worked out for them in one way where they've got, early up, they've got GWS, and I would expect them to win that. So that would hopefully have people up and about. They would be expected to lose to the Bulldogs. The second game at Theberton against Carlton, it's the weaker Melbourne side. They'll be hoping for an upset, but I'd see Carlton win. Their game at Norwood is against Brisbane. Now, I'd put Brisbane as favourites to win that, but it's one that's in the realms of possibility. If everything goes right for the Crows, you know they could knock off the Lions. So some of the games they've got at home, the Victorian side's doubtful, but the GWS and Brisbane games, if they can get two wins, that'd be handy for Adelaide.
Is it Melbourne they've got at TIO?
So I call it home, but it's the Darwin game, obviously. So home for about a third of their squad, which are trained up in Darwin. And came down last weekend for their first joint training session with the SA girls at Footy Park.
I wonder how the integration there's going to go with them doing a lot of stuff over Skype, apparently, the media here is reporting. So that'll be an interesting little experiment. Not to mention the amount of travel that they're going to have to do is comparable to anything GWS and Brisbane will be doing during the series as well.
It'll be interesting to see how Trine works together. I mean, it's something that's not, well, I wouldn't say new, because you've got to remember about 10 years ago when North Melbourne had that split list with their reserves, half played at North Ballarat, half played in Tasmania. And Sydney did the same thing for a little while when the reserves folded. For a little while, they were sending maybe anywhere between half a dozen to 10 players down from Sydney to play for Port Melbourne in the VFL. That happened for a couple of years. So it's not new, but it's certainly awkward.
Just some thoughts on Carlton and Collingwood opening the season. There's some school of thought asking why it's not the Bulldogs and Melbourne, given all the work that they've put in over the years.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think maybe they're just trying to break it up because everyone's used to seeing Melbourne Bulldogs, Melbourne Bulldogs, Melbourne Bulldogs, and I think they're just trying to put that thought in everyone's head of this is a new competition and here are the traditional sides, and trying to get those fans excited about it. And I guess that's the reason why, in one way, Carlton beat out North Melbourne for the final licence. I mean, many people suggest that North Melbourne had a far superior bid, but for Carlton, it was a case of, for the AFL, they'd have with Collingwood two of what they call the traditional big clubs, and like what we've got for the opening game, they can play off on that tradition and hope that creates a bit of press and gets a big crowd in there. And, you know, I think what they'll be hoping for is at 7:40 p.m. that the crowd come out of the city, they just walk over the bridge, they walk down Swan Street and show up at Olympic Park Oval, 5,000 people with free entry, and hopefully that looks good for TV. They need buzz around that first game.
Well, moving along, and you did bring up TV, so we'll segue straight into that. The broadcast deal, of course, was announced last week as well. Foxtel will broadcast all 28 games of the series live. Seven will broadcast the opening game between Carlton and Collingwood, and every Saturday night game will be broadcast live on 7 or 7 Mate, I believe. And the 7-2, I should have said. And Fox Footy's panel was announced, well, part of it was announced today, hosted by Neroli Meadows, with fan favourite Kelly Underwood returning to football commentary. Adam Papalia and Tanya Armstrong also joining Underwood there.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's part of their team. Apparently more will be announced soon. Just quietly, I might be sending them my resume if I can find their email. But it's an interesting team that they're going with Underwood. Underwood certainly is a person that's divided opinion, I think, if you've seen on Big Footy. There's a few in either camp. I've already said publicly what side I lean on, so I don't need to go undertaking out the baseball bat again. It's interesting they've come out with those names. Certainly the teams that the TV teams that are being announced are certainly having a female flavour to it. Channel 9 came out with the Croc Media production, Women's Footy. There'll be an hour every Sunday. They've announced Tiffany Cherry is going to host that. And no doubt soon 7 will probably make an announcement. And I would expect there'll be a female leading up their commentary team. Who that is? Well, that's the mystery.
I actually expected them to announce Jason Bennett, who does their VFL coverage, but he's actually commentating the WBBL at the moment. So
he would be available because the WBBL would finish in late January, so he would be able to switch from WBBL into calling women's football. So I would suggest that he'd be one. He'd probably be the host of the coverage, I believe. It'll be just a case of if they've got a female that will be able to jump into the calling chair. Naturally, one of them which would have been on the boundary would have been something like Abby Holmes, but Abby, of course, has been selected to play for Adelaide, so that would rule her out on a number of occasions. The question is what female are they going to find? Will they pick Croc Media's radio caller Jo Watton? She could be a name out there that might be selected. Because otherwise, we're searching around. Shelley Weir has been a name that's been thrown up from the Mangrook Footy Show. So let's see if either Fox Footy or Seven will try and nab her, if not calling, or at least in boundary or in a hosting role.
Mm. So, yeah, just for mine, Jason Bennett, best football commentator on TV at the moment. But that's my personal opinion. There's no additional media rights income for this, by the way. The AFL hasn't gotten any extra money out of this broadcast and won't until the next deal, probably. But at least for the next 2 years, they're getting production costs are going to be covered by Seven and Fox, but there's no money coming into the league for this. In fact, if you look over other media organisations' TV deals, there's no direct media rights income for netball either. Or cricket, for that matter. Cricket and Channel 10 share the production costs, and Channel 9's deal with netball is strictly revenue sharing. So,
what will be interesting is to see the quality of the broadcasts that are going to be on Foxtel. Now, remember, they've said they're going to be on Foxtel. Now, they haven't said if they're going to be on Fox Footy, or on Fox Sports 1, 2, or 3, or it will be a case of just press red like they did for the West Coast Frio game where it was, you know, one of their back channels. Because the question is, do they obviously have enough broadcast vehicles to get out there to do a full-on production like they do for the men? Because remember, there's going to be, six or seven games on every weekend that the men are playing and plus two or three women's games that are not double-headers. So the question is, are they going to have enough production trucks around the place? And if not, are they going to be using some... Because there's some online streaming companies now that can do anywhere between 3 to 5 cameras. They're not the greatest of quality. They certainly look better than a one-camera operation. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, are they going to be able to get enough technology to be able to give a decent broadcast quality equivalent to or close to what they currently provide for the men?
Well, the Saturday night games, they're all standalones. And Seven will pick up the production for that, I imagine. And that'll just be cross-decked to Fox like the footy is now. So that'll lessen the burden a little bit. I think Fox has enough production coverage to do the rest, and if they don't, they can always outsource it to Eddie McGuire's company, who they own part of. So,
yeah, it will be interesting. But yeah, let's hope that it's all up to standard. And again, just thinking about it now, they might not be on the main Fox Footy channel because obviously, if there's JLT Community Series games on the same time, they'll probably be on Fox Sports 3 or yeah, whatever. But still, great coverage. And all those games, Fox on the 7 games, will be on afl.com.au or through the AFL app as well. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have Foxtel, if you're like me, a bit of a tight, you know what? you can watch it online for nothing.
Now, earlier, the player payment situation was resolved finally. Players getting a 24-week contract, 9 hours training a week. They get income protection for 12 months if they're injured and unable to work. They get their football boots provided. They get runners provided. They have to do 20 hours of appearances. They get an $80 travel allowance for each night they're away from home. Relocation expenses are covered where appropriate, and medical expenses will be covered for 12 months after the contract. that's not a bad deal in the end, with a base payment of $8,500 rising to $9,200 in 2018. It's not bad.
Yeah, it got better, and from the players that I spoke to, they're certainly happier with the deal that the Players Association held out, and finally they came to the table. There was a bit of pressure on the AFL. In fact, back in October, there was the hashtag Boots Off campaign, where even the police were starting to jump in and have a crack at the AFL. So I think the AFL thought, well, for the extra, let's say it cost them $1 million. I'm not sure what the exact figure is. I haven't sat down and did the math. But if it cost them like a few hundred thousand, I think for an organisation that signed a $2.5 billion TV rights deal, I think they're going to think, is it the bad publicity really worth, arguing over a couple of extra hundred thousand? I think they'll just go, let's just do it and let's just, keep them all happy. And, if everyone's happy and it's good publicity, hopefully they can ride the wave, and obviously sponsorship and we'll cover it, and hopefully in years to come, it won't be free games. As much as everyone loves a free game, there'll be obviously then admission charge to games, so there'll be dollars coming in to cover all these costs.
It puts a marquee wage at $27,000 total, if you include ambassadorial duties and things like that. Priority selections getting $12,000. There's also no limit on personal sponsorship for these guys either, which is kind of.
That's the big one. And
that's where the money's to be made.
My Instagram and Twitter feed, particularly the Instagram feed, which I follow a lot of players because you like to follow a bit what they do in their social lives. You can pick up a bit of news. You can kind of, put two and two together on a few things. So many product mentions and vlogs by the players. I'm not sure if they're getting paid much for some of these mentions. I think most of it's just free product, and they're going, hey, look what I've got, mention X brand. Here's a watch from certain company. Here's some boots from X company. There's so much of it being flogged at the moment on Instagram and Twitter. It's almost like they've walked onto the old-fashioned footy show, and here's all your prizes.
I think it'd be a bit of a shock for many of them walking into the club and seeing just what they can actually get now. As well, it's a nice change for them, I guess, in that regard.
It will be, but it'll be also interesting on the flip side, what I call coming back to reality. That is, once the AFL season is finished and they go back to playing state league football, and when they go to state league clubs, it's back to, for many girls as well, it's a case of paying your subs, paying your match fees, paying your membership, paying your insurance to cover you at club level. So, it'll be, it'll be interesting to see how they... I mean, they're already used to it because that's what they've done for years. But from having something so good to then all of a sudden stepping back again from when they have their state league, and obviously the amateurs at that level and don't get paid.
Their contract's for 24 weeks. So are they going to redraft next year? Do we know?
Nothing's been decided. I guess they're obviously, A, waiting on attendance figures, their TV figures, and the quality coming through the academies, if they can, A, extend out to maybe 10 teams the next year. Who knows what their plans are. And if not, I wouldn't be surprised if at least for the Victoria clubs, they'll make them delist X amount of players. It might be a quarter of their list or something like that, just to try and keep it fresh.
Mm. That neatly brings us to expansion, and Simon Lethlean is on the record as saying he doesn't believe that there'll be an expansion before 2019 now, which is, I think St Kilda and Geelong are arcing up a little bit about it. North have made a few comments as well, because evidently when they were given provisional licences, they took it to mean a certainty that they'd be in 2018, but the league seems to have a differing opinion at the moment.
And I think it's a safe bet. I think they want the league to bet in a bit and let the quality get better. Because, if we take it back several months, we're first arguing saying maybe six teams should be the limit. And when everyone said eight, we're going, oh, geez, we're diluting the pool a little here. And I remember the comments a year and a half ago from Mish Cohen when we had the draft for 2015, and I asked her, how many teams do you think we have a good quality players? And she goes, I think we have about three. So, to go from, I think we have three to eight, you've got to have the quality there. And then the question is, are there enough marquee quality players to spread out amongst those other clubs? And there may not be. In fact, if you go through the draft, you pick out some players, one or two that have never played footy that have been drafted, and you go, really? If we're getting to that stage, they haven't played footy and they're being drafted, that shows that we've got a pretty weak talent pool.
But then again, I think they're also following the AFL clubs, in that AFL clubs do pull in their Category B rookies and whatnot who have never even been to the country, let alone played the game. So.
Yeah, category B rookies are completely different, and it's a bit like how they've got the rookie system as well. Yeah, fair enough, the rookies are different, but I'm saying that some players have been drafted, and this is out of the 145 picks. The draft, like you'd want to compare to, say, the normal men's draft, this is, okay, players who have been in the system, as in a youth girl or playing senior women's football, that have a good quality standard, who certainly deserve a national gig. And you've got one or two in there that hadn't played a game, that got drafted as a full-time part-time player, got drafted. So they're eligible to play straight away. And you go, hang on, if they haven't even played state league football this year, I mean, you're really gambling. You don't know what their quality is going to be like. And from watching state league football over the last 2 or 3 years, the quality has just gone from point A to point Z. It has just rapidly improved. And you're thinking, you're going to try and pick a player who may have played junior football but doesn't realise how far the standards come and just plant them straight into a national jumper. It's like, that's risky. Some may make it. Some may make it as a natural, like Bree Davey, but there's others who go, yeah, it might not be up to scratch.
Well, brings me to the International Cup. Obviously, there's a couple of players, Kendra Hale and Laura Corrigan, in particular, who will be, well, not so much Kendra now because of her injury, but obviously Corrigan, who play for Ireland. Well, she plays for Ireland. Kendra played for Canada. Now, with the ice, with the International Cup coming up, how are these guys affected by that?
No one knows at this stage. They're actually seeking clarification. I had a chat with Jason Arnold, the Canadian coach, a little while ago, and I know at that stage, and unfortunately Kendra's now out because of injury, they were going to double check and find out, well, what's the ruling here? Because originally the ruling was introduced for men. You know, if you played AFL football as a male, you couldn't, you know, obviously play in the IC Cup because you'd be that far better than everyone else. So it poses the question of, is it a blanket rule that's going to cover women? And if so, that rules out Laura Corrigan for playing for Ireland. When I was having a chat to Jason about it, we're throwing around a few ideas. You know, originally he was in favour of saying, well, yeah, maybe we should make it the blanket rule. If you played AFL, you can't play in this international competition. And I argued the point with him, you know, just a friendly chat, saying, well, maybe because everything's in its early years, and that women's football, this is important to note, women's football internationally isn't too far away from the Australian State League standard because... Of women's football in Australia has only really been developing the last few years, so it hasn't had much of a head start. I throw the theory of, well, actually, no, it might be better that the Corrigans and the Hiles, etc., are playing in this International Cup because they're playing against these women that, if they can match it with the Hiles and the Corrigans, it makes recruiters go, well, these players are actually pretty good standard. Maybe we should think about recruiting them for 2018.
I'd personally like to see an all-star game take on an Australian side at the end of the women's section of the International Cup. See how they go, because I don't think the quality of the women's game is that far ahead of the international women's game.
What I'd love to see, and keep your eye on girlsplayfooty.com next year when I write an article on this, I would like to see the world, because they select a world team at the end of the carnival. I would like to have, instead of the grand final being played on a Friday or Saturday for women, let's play it a few days earlier. Let's play it on the Wednesday if they can do the draw properly. I'd like to see on the Friday or Saturday the world team come up against an Australian side out of what I call academy players, players that they're trying to prepare for the National League that haven't been drafted. So therefore we get a fair indication of the standard, and therefore if they're able to beat or evenly compete with these academy girls who are there hoping for the next batch to be drafted, that will then give an excellent indication to recruiters of A, our international standard might be far away, or B, if they have that even contest of, oh, actually, they're the even standard and we really should be looking at these women and getting them in to the National League system for 2018.
And just while we're talking women's footy on the international scene, Big Footy's own Renee Tong has been selected in the Canadian side, again, coming down for the next International Cup. It was great news for us, because we love Renee Tong. And she's got her funding, in fact, the entire Canadian women's team has crowdfunding pages up at the moment as they attempt to try and get here. So we encourage you to support our own Canadians. That's right, they're our Canadians.
and get behind them as well, because it's quite expensive. Not only, obviously, the flights to cover, but obviously they're out here for at least 2 weeks. Some for 3 weeks. They come and some actually get here a week earlier and train and get acclimatised to the conditions. Mm. And they've got to pay for all that accommodation. And you've got to imagine they've taken time off work as well. So they're not, for some girls, they're not earning anything during that time as well. So, you know, that's a big hit to them financially. So if you can give them 10 bucks, believe me, you know, 100 people give them 10 bucks means a hell of a lot. So, yeah, certainly throw a little bit of dollars their way. In fact, I've actually, you mentioned Canada. Canada actually announced just recently that they're doing a second tour in 2017. Their Midnight Suns, which is their development women's side, is going over to play. They're calling it a European series. It's still very much in development, but they'll definitely be playing Great Britain, Ireland, and they're thinking of maybe another European team might take them on. So there's talk about a development series for the Canadian teams. And that's, again, not the Northern Lights team. That's their second side, the Midnight Suns, to go over to the UK.
I think the US are planning on only sending one team this International Cup as well.
Two.
They're actually going to send
two.
Both, are they?
Only one will compete in the International Cup. But what they're talking about with their second team, the Liberty, is they will actually play a bunch of Victorian teams down here. So that's what they're hoping, that the development team will come down, play a bunch of practice games, while the Freedom itself will play in the International Cup.
Cool. Excellent. Now, just before we go, the uniforms, Pete. Cotton On got themselves a bargain, I suspect, in the uniform business, manufacturing all uniforms for the women's competition. What did you think of the uniforms?
Well, what can I say? The shorts are certainly a different cut, so that is interesting. The T-shirts are a bit plain-looking, but look great because all the girls are wearing them with all the sponsors all over it, so they're getting a good plug. A comment was made about the Footscray top, how it looks, because of the red, it almost looks like a red collar, so it's a very similar to what they call the EJ Whitten-style jumper, so some of the Footscray fans are happy about that. Melbourne, I think, is smartest, and maybe even Carlton. Carlton's slightly different, but they're staying close to the traditional jumper as possible. I'm always a fan of, hey, you're the one club, you all wear the one jumper.
Yeah.
And it's great to see the Port Adelaide Magpies jumper make a comeback.
Yes, and there was a little bit of a Twitter banter over that. But nothing major. Collingwood, I don't know what they're thinking with that.
Oh, what on earth are the Collingwood Football Club doing? I mean, the girls are running around doing promo shots originally in the two Collingwood jumpers, the white on black and the black on white. And, you know, that looked perfectly fine. And then they come out with this jumper that looks like the Port Adelaide jumper, and you're like, what on earth are you doing and why'd you do that for? You know, I'm probably more of a traditionalist. It's just like, if you're going to be one club, you all wear the same jumper because you are one club.
And that's why I do like the Carlton jumper in particular, because it is very similar to the actual Carlton jumper.
And the interesting thing is I've seen the front of the Adelaide jumper. I haven't seen the back of it. But what caught my eye is, as part of the deal with the Northern Territory, because it was a joint Crows AFL-NT bid for that Crows licence, was that it was going to be a Northern Territory logo or something Northern Territory on the jumper to signify the partnership. They did that in the game against, there was the SA Red versus Blue game, I think it was. They had like a Northern Territory logo or outline on the back of their jumper. I haven't seen it on the Crows jumper. I haven't seen the back of it, but the front of it doesn't say anything or signify anything Northern Territory. So until I see the back, I don't know if they've upheld their end of the bargain.
They'd want to, because they've chipped in a fair amount of money, the Northern Territory government now. They doubled their commitment not too long ago.
And the SA government chipped in $250K as well.
Mm. And they're not going to get any credit for that. Oh, it's been a good chat, Pete. Anything else we should know about before we go?
Yes, of course. Some big news happening out of the respective state leagues. First of all, over in South Australia, there will be a sandfill competition. It's a four-team competition. The teams escape me off the top of my head. I think it might be Glenelg, South Adelaide, West Adelaide, and maybe Norwood. Apologies if I got the four wrong, but four sandfill clubs will be having a women's competition. So sandfill women's running at the same time as the AFLW competition. That draw is coming out soon.
That's Glenelg, North Adelaide, Norwood and West Adelaide.
Thank you very much for that. So that will be, as I said, they'll be playing each other twice and having a grand final. So again, mimicking the AFLW competition before the SAWFL takeover. In Tasmania, they've done a restructure there where what's happened is there's now a five-team Premier League that was announced today. The TWL will be Glenorchy, Clarence, Kingborough Tigers, Burnie and Launceston. The other three teams that used to be in the competition are now being put into regional competitions. They're going to be, I think, a North-Northwest and a Southern competition. So those new clubs will join them. So it'll be two split regionals and a state-based competition. And in Victoria, controversially, they have closed down the Victorian Women's Football League. Not to be confused with the VFL League Women's competition. They've both got the same letters. They've both got the same words, but all around the other way. The VFL Women's competition that started last year is continuing. The VWFL, which was running for 35 years, the AFL Victoria took over it 3 years ago, have said, oh, it's all too difficult to run, so we're shutting it down. Interesting call.
Is that going to regions? Are those teams going to regions, are they?
Yes, they are. And what happens is they're now being split into the same men's competitions. So Northern Football League, Eastern Football League is going to have a competition. There's now a South East competition. It's all kind of going to merge properly into the men's comps once more teams come along. But what's interesting to note is, say, for example, in the Northern Football League, the team from Bendigo Thunder is playing in the Northern Football League. So, you know, you scratch your head going, huh, what? And the Geelong Magpies, who have jumped out of the VFL to allow the Geelong Cats to go in, the Geelong Magpies will be playing in the Goldfields competition. So they'll be going up and down all around Ballarat. So and St Kilda Sharks will now be playing, one of their sides will be playing down in the South East competition all the way down in Frankston. So you're scratching your head going, huh, what?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a mess, but yes, interesting that they shut down the VWFL competitions. I'm calling shenanigans.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the restructuring had to happen, not necessarily like this, but I mean, and restructuring is something that happens in Tasmania every other year anyway. But I think it's like their national sport is restructuring. But anyway. I think restructuring was going to happen more and more as the women's sport developed. It really is coming out of nowhere. And for all that there are a lot of Victorian teams, it was always going to be segmented down eventually.
I think so as well. I thought there would be smaller competitions. But as I always said, why did they have to create a new VFL women's competition, which is until now Geelong Box Hill have joined, which was the VWFL clubs anyway? Why couldn't you have just kept it and called it VWFL? Because they're, like I said, they're using exactly the same letters and exactly the same words, just mixed around the other way. It's like, well, why did you have to start this whole new thing when you could have just kept the current thing going? And, you know,
branding,
it's kind of puzzling.
It's all about branding.
Oh, exactly, exactly. You know, as a bit of VFA support, where it's now called the VFL, indeed, about branding.
I mean, I've got it in for the Sandfall taking over women's footy out of nowhere, really, but...
Yeah, let me just say, that was very interesting. When the Sandfall came along last year and started this girls' competition for 14s and 16s tied to the Sandfall clubs, and it was proposed then of, oh, no, up until under 16s, it'll be the Sandfall, and then after 18s, it'll be you'll go to an SAWFL club. As soon as I saw that, I go, nah.
Yeah.
Sandfall clubs are not going to pour money into junior girls and let them go elsewhere. They're going to want their own senior women's side. They want their investment to stay right at their club. This thing's a front. This thing will be, and I guarantee you, within a year or two, maybe the SAWFL maybe will survive, maybe as an amateur competition, but it will be overtaken by the Sandfall Women's Comp. It will happen, guaranteed.
It is interesting that the Sandfall's Women's Comp is going to run at the same time as the AFL Women's Comp, and not during the regular season.
That is something curious. And nothing's been announced out of that in Victoria. I mean, Victoria have had its Women's Academy, and their Women's Academy has some trial games, so it's an unofficial competition, but, you know, they just play a few practice matches. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if something popped up in Victoria at the last second of, oh, we're going to do this. Watch this space to see if they do anything in Victoria as a way of, particularly for the players that don't get selected in the AFLW matches, because it's 22 per week, if for the extra three or four that miss out if they're going to have them playing in trial games or some preseason comp or something to keep them fresh.
Mm. Well, Pete, I reckon that's about it for this week. I think we've neatly covered everything.
Indeed, a heck of a lot to get through on women's football, but can you believe it? We're something like 54 sleeps away, maybe less, from the start of the competition. So, yes, it's almost creeping up upon us.
And we'll be back just before that to talk more about women's footy, or we might be back earlier if anything actually happens that's worth discussing. But thanks very much for your time, Pete. Have a good Christmas.
Always a pleasure. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and always good to see you on the Women's Footy Forum at bigfooty.com.
Or you can visit girlsplayfooty.com as well for all your news and events and things like that that they talk about there.